This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by SolarWinds. Did you know you can discover, map, and monitor your network in under an hour? SolarWinds award-winning Network Performance Monitor is an affordable, easy-to-use tool that delivers real-time views and dashboards to help you detect, diagnose, and resolve issues before real damage is done. Visit SolarWinds.com for a fully functional 30-day trial of Network Performance Monitor today. You're listening to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a technical show about the data networking industry. Home base for us is packetpushers.net. We talk to fellow engineers and subject matter experts from all over the world about nerdy networking stuff. Today is January 26th, 2013, and our topic is OSPF design. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter, host for today's program, and with me is, first up, Darren O'Connor, who is hailing from London. And say hi, Darren.
Hello, my name is Darren. I'm a network architect at a ISP in London. I have a blog as well, melody.co.uk/CCIE, and you can follow me at MellowDrifter on Twitter as well.
Thanks for joining us, sir. And also, Mr. Paul Gear, who is up past his bedtime. Paul, you're about an hour north of Brisbane in Australia, yes?
That's right. G'day. Thanks for having me. We just finished Australia Day here, but instead of having a barbie at the beach, I've been stuck inside because there's a tropical cyclone up north.
Stay safe and out of the weather, sir, because it's your summer. On up here, it is winter, and I'm here in New Hampshire where it is quite cold, as is Derek Winkworth. You're in the frozen Midwest of North America. Pretty cold there too, eh?
Yeah, it's a bit cold, but I don't go outside when it's like this, so I don't know how cold it is exactly. It's been cold. We were like negative 25 at the beginning of this week at one point.
That's what I would call unspeakably cold, and I had a few mornings like that here. It doesn't get, since New Hampshire is more towards the Atlantic coast, it doesn't get quite as cold as where you get. I mean, you're basically a suburb of Canada. Well, all right, let's jump into OSPF design. Now, this came up as a topic on the forum, and forum.packetpushers.net, we have a community of network engineers that exchange ideas, problem solve, and different things like that, and we have one of the forum areas allows you to participate in show design, what we're going to talk about on the show. This program, then, is a result of questions that came up from people that were on the forum that were interested in having a podcast that discussed issues of OSPF design. So OSPF is an interior gateway routing protocol, like, say, RIP as a very basic one, EIGRP as another popular one in Cisco shops. OSPF, Derek, we were talking about this before the show. I mean, Derek, your attitude about OSPF is if you're going to run an IGP, that's the one you want to run.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been a while that way for me, but I've largely worked in multi-vendor environments, and that's just been the default because of that. And it's pretty mature. It's been obviously OSPF has been around for a very long time, and different vendors' implementations have grown and are pretty stable. So it's an obvious choice.
Yeah, an obvious choice. I would agree with that. You do see EIGRP out there quite a lot, and there are many folks that will argue somewhat passionately about whether you should run OSPF or EIGRP in a given network. Those arguments are passionate for whatever folks' reasons are, but the fact of the matter is if you run a network that requires equipment from multiple vendors, then OSPF is really where you want to be because you've got as Derek just said, a mature protocol that is well-known and implemented across a variety of vendor equipment, meaning you can talk to Cisco, can talk to Juniper, can talk to Brocade, can talk to Avaya, can talk to whatever, fill in the blank, and they can all exchange routing information. So I'm going to assume here that most of the people that are listening have some basic idea of how OSPF works. We could spend a lot of time going into the rudiments of things like areas and the area types and what all the link state advertisements are and those types. But that information, which I'll link to in the show notes, is readily available on even on Wikipedia. Cisco's got a OSPF design guide. It's from 2005, but it's still a very useful document that holds true. And then there's been endless amounts of writing about the fundamentals of OSPF in the blogosphere. So there is one question that I wanted to address that actually, Paul, you had brought up, which regards a very fundamental setting in OSPF, which is the reference bandwidth. Paul, why don't you posit that question, and then we can discuss that a bit.
Well, the main deal is obviously you need to have the same reference bandwidth across your entire OSPF implementation. And because of that, thinking about how far into the future your bandwidth is going to grow, it seemed to me like, is it something that we need to think about ahead of time? Obviously, if you get it wrong, then you've ended up in a situation where you can't distinguish between, say, a 1 gig link and a 10 gig link from a cost perspective. But if you get it too far in advance, is that going to cause issues? I couldn't think of any negatives, but I was more hoping to hear your wisdom on this.
So the reference bandwidth is the bandwidth that is used by OSPF to determine the cost of a given link. And the default reference bandwidth that's there is 100 megabits per second, which back in the day was certainly an adequate bandwidth, and you didn't see a lot of links higher than that way back in the day. Now, of course, Paul, like you just mentioned, 10 gigabit links are common. And so if you want to be able to distinguish in an OSPF shortest path calculation a difference between a 10 gig link and a 1 gig link, you need to change your reference bandwidth from the 100 megabit per second default to something else. Now, Darren, you work in a service provider environment. How do you guys handle that reference bandwidth issue?
When I first became a network architect, we were still sitting on a reference band of a 10 gig. And obviously at the time, 10 gig was one, but we had quite a lot of 10 gig links in the network. So it wasn't going to be adequate for the foreseeable future. So we changed that all to 100 gig. We had a plan works to get it done. But for our OSPF V3 implementation, I thought, you know, well, even 100 gig, you know, a couple of years down the line, that might be pretty common, at least for our core links. So, let's just put it at, you know, 1 terabit per second. That should be, you know, should last us. I mean, I think the only, initially, the only thing that's a little bit confusing is that, you know, when people start looking at metrics, they see huge numbers, but, you know, big numbers doesn't really matter. But yes, I do think you should, you know, set it to something like, you know, at least higher than 100 gig anyway.
That brings up a question for me. Does anyone know what sort of size integers the cost metrics are in OSPF? Like, is it limited to 32 bits or 64 bits?
Yeah, I think it's a 4.2 billion value. I could actually...
So it's a 32-bit integer, essentially.
It must be. In iOS, the maximum is 4.2 million, but that is in terms of megabits per second. So you're looking at 4.2 million bits per second, which is, that's 4.2 terabits per second?
That's... a number so absurdly large, it's sure to be safe at least a year or two.
So, yeah, and I would agree with where you guys are heading. Even though the metrics end up large, as Darren pointed out, when you change the reference bandwidth to something that can grow with as large as your largest network links are likely to grow in the foreseeable future, which, Darren, in your case, you said you set it all the way up to a terabit, then, you do get big metrics, but it's all relative. You're still going to be choosing the correct paths. It's just...
It's similar to, you know, when IGRP, for example, went to EIGRP. IGRP had very small metrics. EIGRP has very large metrics, but it doesn't stop anyone from using it. It's just, yes, it's maybe a little bit more difficult to work in your head, but, you know, routers can do that pretty quickly.
I was just wondering whether it ended up being too large in some cases, depending on the size of it. Like if you've got a really small 64K link or something and you set to 4 terabits, does that actually push you up towards the limit of cost metrics?
Yes, I have seen that before. If it's too big, then, you know, like maybe 128K link and a 64-bit link could be both at the maximum metric. So yes, then you could have a slight issue. It's pretty difficult. You've got to think about your network. If you're running 100 gig links and 64K links in the same network, I mean, it's not impossible, but
You're probably not going to care about the difference between 64K and 128K, are you?
Yeah.
Different sort of an application there. Whereas a service provider environment with a super fast core is going to have really big links. Maybe a small enterprise core that's got some long distance links over really small bandwidth. I mean, totally different worlds. Like you said, Darren, seems unlikely you would see those sorts of disparities between maximum and minimum bandwidths that you experience in the same OSPF environment.
Yeah.
Well, there's two designs we wanted to consider on the show today. You know, one is, this actually came up on Twitter now that I think about it. I don't know if it was something that I read or something that that someone had sent me an email on, but the question had come up, is there a point in having multiple areas in OSPF anymore? And contextually, that is because routers are so much more powerful today that it's a lot easier for them to do the shortest path first calculations. And if you say that, if you consider that the original intent of areas, or one of the original intents of areas, was to contain routes and link state updates into a specific area and then limit the number of calculations that a set of routers would have to do, that you would make decisions on how to when to create a new area based on the number of routes that you were supporting and the number of routers that were there, and come up with kind of an idea of how many areas that you should have based on the size of your network topology. But now router power, just the raw CPU power and their ability to do computations continues to grow along with the power of silicon. So is there even a need at this point to have things in multiple areas, or have break your OSPF design up into multiple areas? Derek, I would appreciate your take on this, where we were and why we did multiple areas versus when you commonly see one area now.
Any time I've ever done multiple areas, it was actually not because of, scale or number of devices in the area. Even when I was service provider is a little bit different case, but if you consider that people actually run routing protocols with hosts like mainframes, and now even like virtual routers inside of VMs, and with load balancers, I think like Citrix F5 will support OSPF. While Cisco's and Juniper's and traditional networking vendors, have fantastic implementations that scale pretty well. You shouldn't make the assumption that IBM's OSPF implementation on the mainframe is all that good. And in those cases, it's best to break off those things into their own areas. Like, if you have a whole bunch of load balancers running OSPF, they should be in their own area, so that they're not impacted by LSA, updates, from a very large area zero. You're also generally not going to be doing MPLS traffic engineering on load balancers or on mainframes. You don't want to introduce, opaque LSAs to those kinds of OSPF implementations, because it could, I've seen it cause bugs. So it's best to kind of cordon those things off into their own area.
So if you're doing a single area design, basically whatever your one area would be, I was going to say area zero, but it certainly doesn't have to be area zero if you're just using one. I think that would be most common. But when do you look at that, Derek, and say, I'm going to do just one area?
By default, you should just assume, keep it simple. Your design should start off with one area. And then figure out as you grow and expand, you should evaluate, should I have more areas? When I introduce more to my network, another data center or this area of the data center, or, you merge and there's this whole other section, a whole other network, do you put that in another area? I mean, that's really when you should be evaluating that. If you're greenfielding, at this point, you should just assume there's going to be one area, area zero. Because that design choice will actually help you later when you introduce other things like OSPF or I'm reading about opaque LSAs to support SDN and things like that, and those things don't pass area border routers, you should just start with one, and then like I said, make that evaluation later whether or not you should add additional areas.
As a practical design consideration, there were issues back in the day. Well, how many routers can you really scale a single area to? And there was kind of a rule of thumb that said 50 routers in a single area is probably about the max that you'd want to go. 50 route, and I think the idea was the number of routes that 50 routers are likely to be supporting, the OSPF calculations that is likely to incur based on an assumed amount of route churn. 50 routers is about as big as you want to go, and from there you'd want to break it up. But I think, I mean, Derek, for the application that you're talking about, and Darren, you do comment on this. If you're in a big service provider environment with lots of high-end iron that can really crank out the calculations, I mean, how many routers do you, in a service provider environment, how many routers do you put in a single area?
I'd be more than happy with a few hundred.
So have you seen issues beyond 100? Like, have you seen that before?
No. I mean, I've even stick a smaller ISRG2 into, you know, a fairly big network just to see. And I don't see even that struggling. I think a bigger problem I see today of smaller devices in a big area is not so much the SPF computation, you know, on the CPU. It's more, especially if the network's fairly large, if you've got a lot of LSAs and those need to be stuck in the routing table, those smaller devices obviously have limited fib. And I've seen quite a few smaller devices suddenly, you know, run out of fib space, and then suddenly they're running in software. CPU-wise, it's hardly a blip. So I mean, the argument that, you know, you should make your small areas to save CPU, I don't think that's, you know, valid for many years, to be honest. It's more to do with fib. But I mean, you know, bigger routers that we have in the core, they don't have problems with that. And, you know, I even see big, you know, core routers maybe running their SPF algorithm, you know, 150,000 times, but not creating a problem at all. They're still doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Darren, how many problems would you have with link flapping, and would you consider that part of the as part of your decision making process? I assume that you're aiming for WAN links that are just, you know, staying up and not mm-hmm. being a problem, but how much flapping do you see, and should that be part of the equation?
I suppose that could be a problem. I mean, generally what I see is the links that flap the most are maybe, you know, the links to the edge. Now, if you think when a router needs to run its SPF computation, it's when it receives certain types of LSAs. If you receive type 5 LSAs, for example, it doesn't run SPF because it's already run an SPF to the ASBR and standard before, so it only needs to add, you know, it's kind of works as a distance vector protocol, if you will. So that means that, you know, if your edge routers, if you will, if they're external facing interfaces, those are flapping, that's not going to really create a problem. It's not like the routers are going to be churning through their, you know, SPF algorithm all the time. But yes, I mean, if you do have a link flapping, I mean, we've had links flap, and I've never seen high CPU on a router suddenly saying, well, you know, I'm running my SPF algorithm hundreds of thousands of times. I've never seen that as a problem.
Yeah, I suspect that's left over from the days when it was a Cisco 2500 that was a WAN edge router that, you know, was handling a fractional T, and it just wasn't a lot of power there. And so if you're dealing with routers on that scale, particularly in a, you know, in an enterprise environment, which maybe would have been where that had fit, again, back in the day, that was where that rule of thumb came from. Derek, kind of same question to you. I mean, how big have you... have you seen OSPF areas grow? You know, a single area. How many routes? How many routers?
So it's always been, you know, area zero. And honestly, in larger service provider networks, there could be thousands of routers in an area, thousands. And there's a number of features in OSPF that were sort of introduced to help with that kind of scale. So that's a very good point that Darren made with or Paul about you know, he put a G1 or G2 ISR in the network. You didn't see a whole lot of CPU head, and that's a very good point to point out, because that's not even an MX960 or a Cisco 7600 or something with real horsepower for CPU. It really is left over from the old days, that the notion that you had to really limit the number of routers inside of an area. I have actually, I'm cheating a little bit here, and I'm listening, but I'm also looking at Jeff Doyle's OSPF and ISIS book, and he gives four reasons why that's kind of no longer true. And the number one reason, of course, is increased router performance and memory capacity. The sophistication of physical and logical router architectures increase sophistication, so they can handle more SPF calculations and with larger data sets. Increased base of experience designing operating large complex networks, and the fourth reason was vendor experience designing sophisticated SPF process, basically the software architecture or software design of the code that's doing OSPF on the box. All those are true. I think this book too is a few years old. It's 7 years old, and this was written then. And I think it's somewhere in this book he talks about networks with thousands of routers in a single area.
Then let's move on to why you would want to do multiple areas. Now, speaking from my own experience dealing with a network, well, in this case it was a state government network that supported about 10,000 hosts, not routers, but actually end hosts that are, out on the edge. So a good-sized enterprise network, but far from a massive service provider kind of a network. The logic behind multiple areas was, there were multiple reasons. One was, in this particular state organization, every agency had started out with its own network, and most of the larger agencies had developed their own OSPF network. And later, that OSPF network was joined into a unified network where all the state agencies were able to exchange data across a common network infrastructure. And the routing topology that was used was OSPF. The situation was, now we've got state agencies talking to each other across this unified network, but everybody's got an already existing OSPF infrastructure. How are we going to join them together? Well, the way to join them together was assign an agency, an area, bring them into or connect that area that defined that agency to the backbone area, Area Zero, that was at the topological and logical center of the network, and route traffic in that way. Pretty straightforward. And it was, it allowed for the agencies to talk to themselves and to their own offices via their own area. And then if they needed to talk to common services in a centralized data center or to exchange information with other state agencies, they would traverse the backbone area and then route into the other agency's area. Straightforward design. You can kind of see it in your mind, sort of a hub and spoke, where the center of the network was this unified data center that everybody plugged into, and then all the spokes were each agency, typically each off in their own area. And I'm simplifying it and generalizing it, and there were certainly exceptions to that rule, and sometimes smaller agencies got thrown into the same area because it was simple to do that, and so on. But those boundaries made sense. They were split up by business unit, I guess, if you want to translate it into a corporate environment. And that worked very well. What multi-area environments have you guys seen, and what were your reasons for having them in multi-areas? Derek, you had talked about this a little earlier.
With an area border router, of course, you can do filtering and summarization at the area, at the area border. And that can be extremely useful, especially if you're merging networks together. What I was trying to say earlier is, there's actually all kinds of devices run OSPF now, and different appliances. And anyone who's ever worked in financial services know mainframes run OSPF. And you really don't want to introduce opaque LSAs or, any kind of, LSA, a lot of LSA changes to some of those implementations, because they're just not mature yet. Or it can cause problems, and I've actually seen this quite a bit. So, you know, we generally put those things into their own area when they're running OSPF.
Paul, I know you've done some OSPF design for some of the smaller networks that you support and have seen some multi-area, I believe, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is out of my desire to produce a topology or a design that is elegant and applies the things that I'm learning in my studies as much as out of any real necessity.
One of the things I'll comment on exactly that is if you go through a route switch certification process with Cisco, one of the things they're going to beat into your head, no matter what the routing topology is the usefulness of summarization and the best practices built around summarization. So if you're studying EIGRP, they're going to give you a plan, like an IP scheme. Okay, I'm going to take this /16 network. I am going to assign it to this group of offices, and each subgroup in there is going to get a /24 out of that, let's say. But there's going to be a border router at the edge of that that autonomous system that's going to summarize all of that address space into that 1/16, so that the only route that makes it into the core is the /16. With OSPF, that's the same sort of a design principle that they're going to talk about. And one of the ways that you do that is by using multiple areas and summarizing at the area border router. So you can have an area border. You can have an area that is a stub area. A stub area, you can summarize at the area border router and send nothing more than a summary route of 0.0.0.0. Just send a default route in to that area so that the routers in that area know, if I don't have a specific explicit route for it, I'm just going to dump all my traffic into the backbone area, into area 0, and let them figure out how to do it. And so your routing tables and those routers in that stub area look very tidy. All it has in it is routes local to that area, and then one big fat summary route, default route that's being advertised from the backbone area. That's nice and neat. Now, you guys that have worked in the big service provider environments might go, yeah, but who cares? I got thousands of routes or thousands of routers and maybe tens of thousands of routes or maybe even hundreds of thousands of routes in a huge environment, I suppose. I mean, do you guys even care about route summarization? How do you think about that stuff? I mean, Darren, what is that? Mm-hmm. Is that even part of the equation for you?
Not really, because I think summarization is more to make things human readable, and routers don't care whether, you know, you've got to look through 50 routes or one summary. It's more to make it, you know, easier for us to troubleshoot things, maybe. There are other ways you can summarize as well. You don't always have to only summarize on an ABR. I suppose it depends on what you're trying to do there. But for example, we have a PE router, and it has maybe 100 CPEs connected. Now, we used to have a /50 over each of those links, and that was advertised into OSPF, into area 0. So for 100 routers, you manage that. You've now got 100/30s in your topology. I didn't want to stick it into another area, so what I just simply did was I made a static route to /16 that covered all of those 100 routes, /30s, and then just redistributed that single static route into the network. So even though that key route is still in area 0, it's also just become an ASBR. It's redistributed as a single S16. OSPF can then be removed of all the /30 links, and it has essentially originated a single /16 in area 0 without any bother about any other routers. Of course, if those other CPEs had networks behind them, you still need to be running OSPF with them. So it doesn't always work. But, I mean, that's an example of being able to summarize on an ASBR in area 0 if you have to. But yeah, I think going to back to the first point, summarization makes it easier for us to read tables maybe, but routers don't care at the end of the day.
Yeah, especially now. I mean, Derek, you were talking about this when you're reading from the Jeff Doyle book. Routers have been optimized. The silicon has been optimized. The software has been optimized in such a way that being able to do route lookups very quickly through thousands and thousands and thousands of entries is not a big deal anymore.
Yeah, not at all. And there's actually, because of the maturity of OSPF as well, once, like, for instance, in whether you're building an MPLS core and an enterprise or service provider network, OSPF just kind of works. It's not often you have to actually troubleshoot the OSPF database. Because of that, it becomes very easy just to make one giant area, and then you never really have to not even every day or every week are you in there, you know, examining the OSPF database because of an issue. It just kind of runs and works. And I don't know, it's a part of it is, you know, spend less time introducing a hierarchy or a topology or a design that's, in my mind, not necessary. And it's actually simplifies other things when you do it that way. If you're running an MPLS network, then traffic engineering, it's a lot easier to do traffic engineering with a single area than it is multi-area traffic engineering.
That brings up an issue for me. How is that going to change when, as we move to IPv6? The issue of summarization, is it going to become a much larger issue? I've certainly seen reports of implementation quirks where IPv6 support is, you know, it's stated on a piece of equipment, but it's not quite so smoothly integrated as the IPv4 support, and that sort of thing is not really clearly stated in the documentation until you really dig in.
As for, I mean, summarization IPv6, I think it goes back down to, you know, IPv4 again. It really depends on your network. I don't see, even inside an enterprise network especially, but, you know, even in a service provider network, I don't think, you know, you're not going to redistribute BGP into OSPF anyway. So, you know, it's not like you're going to have 100,000 IPv6 routes anytime soon. At least my box can take, you know, a lot more than that. So I'm still happy with lots and lots of routes at the table. I don't have a problem with that.
When you do bitwise operations on an address, now it's a 32-bit address, and it's easy to fit that into a register and do a logical operation on it, like an XOR or NOR or whatever you have to do, you know, to do prefix lookups or summaries, or, you know, to when you're looking at the mask and trying to figure out the net or whatever operation is being performed in the router on that prefix. And now you have 128 bits that doesn't fit into a register. And I think, you know, that this fundamentally, I guess the point I'm making is that I'm not quite certain that vendors' implementations are ready, you know, to really scale with a huge number of routes in various conditions. Certainly not the implementations we see on appliances now. So I think that's going to be an issue, and we're going to have growing pains as that, you know, we end up with lots and lots and lots of routes, you know, with 128-bit prefixes or 120-bit, you know, addresses with 128-bit masks and so on. We're going to see, I think it's going to be an interesting time as we kind of grow in, with IPv6.
So let's pause for a moment here and kind of summarize what we've discussed so far. So we really got into the one area approach, which from what Derek and Darren are experiencing, you can run one area and that's fine. You do multiple areas if you have a specific reason to isolate some group of devices for whatever their OSPF implementation might be that may not interact well with more mature OSPF implementations. But you can, from a standpoint of number of devices, a number of routes, modern networking equipment is probably not going to have any sort of an issue scaling up as big as you're likely to need it, especially in an enterprise environment. Because I know a lot of you guys that are listening to this program are enterprise guys with that kind of a background. Now, there are other scenarios for multiple areas where it could be joining companies together. You may need to do multiple areas, or you may wish to take advantage of the way OSPF can do summarization, split it up on boundaries, where the area border router is doing summarization for you. But as Darren pointed out, that's not specifically necessary for the sake of the hardware. It's maybe more necessary for you because you're looking at routing tables and troubleshooting issues like that, and like to have a nice tidy routing table to review things. And it's also, you know, just for good design and best practice, it's nice to have a good clean IP scheme that you're working with as you are dealing with, again, especially an enterprise network. It's awful nice if you can do that. You know, other reasons I can think of where you might want to separate into multiple areas, are really more convenience items. You geographically, perhaps it works for you to group a certain number of routers that are your EMEA routers are going to be an area, your North America routers are an area, and your APAC routers are going to be in an area. That's a plausible design, I guess, where you may have reason to do that. Then there are security boundaries where you may wish to, because the nature of OSPF is to force all traffic from one area through the backbone area to get to another area. And there's an excellent explanation that Jeff Doyle has for this that he posted on Network World about why that is. If you're wondering, why does everything have to go through the backbone area? It has to do with loop prevention. And I will link to that in the show notes, that he explains it, you know, very well. But anyway, you could take advantage of that for security purposes, because you know traffic is going to have to traverse one or a certain number of area border routers, and you could use those as security checkpoints between one area and another. I don't suppose that that's a common thing, but certainly it's a good way that you could do that. You could group by WAN interface type, for example. There was a scenario I remember with a large DSL deployment where the carrier was mapping all of the remote DSL circuits into particular ATM PVCs. And we, depending on, so the DSL was coming to one PVC, and they also had frame relay they were mapping into another ATM PVC for us, and there were a few other topology types that they were bringing in like that, and we kept each PVC in its own area because there was a lot of churn going on as those circuits went up and went down, and at the time that was useful to us to reduce the number of LSAs that were being advertised and then withdrawn. And so on. Although, as Derek and Darren have both said today, yeah, that probably doesn't matter so much anymore. So another question that came up in the forum thread as we were designing what the outline was going to be for this show was that of timers. What do you guys that have done your big OSPF networks, what have you done if it is something other than default timers in your OSPF environments? Darren, you want to take a shot?
In our core, we use BFD, and we actually just leave the timers to default, although in theory you could
pause for just a second and explain what bidirectional forwarding detection is and what it accomplishes.
Okay, so we use BFD. BFD is a lightweight protocol that's generally, depending on the hardware implementation, it's something that the actual hardware itself is sending and receiving these hello frames to say, I'm still alive, I'm still alive. It's also very quick. If BFD goes down, if it doesn't receive its hellos, enough of them, three in a row, then it can actually inform upper protocols, like OSPF or whatever, that this link is no good, bring it down.
It knows at a physical layer, down at layer one effectively, when a link has gone away, much faster, he can detect that link failure much faster than the OSPF default timer would detect, hey, I think my neighbor's gone, and then cause a convergence event. So
yeah, if routers are directly connected to each other via cable, then generally if the one side goes down or the cable goes down, both interfaces realize that very quickly. But obviously, quite often that's not the case. Either it could be going through a switch, it could be going through a couple of media converters, it could be going through a VLL or VPLS or something, where if one side goes down, it doesn't necessarily take the other side down. And then OSPF takes quite a long time to figure out, actually, my neighbor's not there anymore. Maybe I should, pull him down and go somewhere else.
So your scheme then is leave the timers as defaults, but use BFD, bidirectional forwarding detection, to make sure that the underlying transport is actually functioning correctly.
Yep.
Derek, what about you?
I would recommend the same approach. There are some implications when fiddling with timers, right? Whether it's BFD or the OSPF timers themselves. OSPF is, if you were to draw a sort of like a layer diagram that shows the dependencies of different control plane protocols on OSPF, like LDP and BGP are both, in a way, they have a dependency on OSPF. And I've actually seen in a production network where people are studying or they're reading documentation. They say, oh, there's this timer and I can turn it down. We'll have faster convergence. And they do that on multiple protocols. So they'll do it for LDP, they'll do it for OSPF, they'll do it for BGP, and they'll set all those timers to be the same or very close to each other. And this can actually cause oscillations in the network because when you do that, you're not giving OSPF enough time to recover so that you don't actually cause a BGP flap or an LDP flap. It's so if you set them all to like 300 millisecond, you know, BFD 100 millisecond interval and 300 millisecond timeout or whatever, if you set that for all protocols, then if there's an event that's longer than 300 milliseconds, you're timing all those protocols out. And you really don't want to do that. You want, if you set to 100 milliseconds and 300, or, you know, 300 and 900 actually is, I think, a recommended value now. At the OSPF level, you actually want three times that on a higher layer protocol like LDP or BGP that's actually dependent upon OSPF. That way, OSPF has enough time to recover and LDP and BGP don't flap along with it. And it's actually quite ugly. When all those protocols go down at once on a node, then they all have to come back up and converge at once, right? You know, that's usually a 2 a.m. call when that kind of thing happens.
Yeah. So if you're following along with this, I mean, Derek is really talking about an MPLS core that's got BGP and then underlying OSPF and the ripple effect that can happen if you set your timers too aggressively. I know what I'll do. I want everything to converge super fast when there's a failure in the network, so I'm going to set my timers to some ridiculously low level, some sub-second level. Okay, so you do that, and then and you set all your timers and all your protocols really aggressively like that. Some transient event happens, or there's a link flap that happens, or there's a persistent link flap that happens, causing a whole bunch of link state events to happen in the network. OSPF is then impacted, which then can impact BGP trying to talk to endpoints, which can then impact MPLS label exchange as well. And all of a sudden you've got, well, someone's on the phone talking to you at 2 a.m. So on an enterprise where you perhaps are not dealing with MPLS or not dealing with any routing protocol other than OSPF, super aggressive timers can bite you as well. And not just super aggressive timers can bite you anywhere, whether it's OSPF or whether it's, say you're a Cisco shop using HSRP as a first hop redundancy protocol. When you set hyper aggressive timers, you're trying to do it sub-second, you know, down into the, you know, just a few hundred milliseconds to react to an event. You are making an assumption that everything else in your network is functioning absolutely perfectly. You're really setting yourself up for one particular kind of an event. A link went down or a router crashed, a particular neighbor went away, and that he's going to stay away, and then reacting to that event very quickly. But the reality of most failures is that they're not that way. The reality of most failures is not a complete failure. It's more of a transient failure where it's working and then it's not working, or things have slowed down for some particular reason because, say, you've got a layer 3 forwarding engine that's kind of lost its mind a little bit, and sometimes he's pushing traffic through and sometimes he's not. Or you've got a high CPU event where some critical router in your infrastructure is pegged for some reason. And so some stuff's getting forwarded through and is working and some stuff is not. When you set super aggressive timers and have that kind of a transient problem or a pegged CPU, you just made your problems worse because now you're reacting to events and reconverging and then reacting to another failure event and then reconverging when things settle back down again. But it just keeps going on and on again, and you're exacerbating the problem with that that very aggressive timer. Getting off my soapbox now, my approach is with any protocol, I assume that the default timers are probably going to be adequate for my environment until I know from a design perspective that there's some reason I need to tune them, and then I will tune them cautiously. It is very rare that I've dinked with timers under any circumstance, as I just have. It's almost never that I found a need where I had to do that. And there's very few circumstances where I would feel comfortable doing that for the scenarios like Derek was talking about. Now, Paul, just from a practical standpoint, I'm curious to know, have you run into BFD, which both Darren and Derek have recommended?
Not in the scenario that you guys are talking about. I've run into it in the case where I'm creating HP IRF stacks and they require BFD to keep the stack split brain from occurring.
BFD, I think, is one of those protocols that is, it's somewhat recently added to the arsenal, I guess, of tools that network engineers can use. But its use to bring down a neighbor adjacency, I think, is somewhat more recent. So it's been a while since I've been through some of the training courses. I'm not sure how prevalent BFD is being taught out there in the CCNP courses and so on. I just did my CCIE research, and BFD doesn't show up at all on the routes. I just did the route switch. And so I think maybe there's a training gap there. I don't know.
I certainly haven't run into it in the CCNP training materials so far, but I'm still in a early sort of stages of that. Just a question back on the timer issue. Have you guys seen issues where the default timers are problematic because you end up with your dead time being longer than your TCP retransmits? What do you do in an environment where it's highly essential to keep those, not to drop the TCP connections, I guess is my question.
Now, you're talking about TCP of traffic that's transiting the router. You're not talking about traffic that's originating the router to keep up the neighbor adjacencies, right?
Correct. Stuff that's transiting. So let's say you've got, high volume websites or something like that, and you don't want people to have the appearance of HTTP errors coming back when your TCP connection times out or whatever.
So just to make sure I'm clear on what you're asking, when reconvergence happens, there's a period where traffic is getting blackholed because a router doesn't trust the routes yet, right? I mean, that's why we have three times the interval and blah blah blah. We're kind of the routers are waiting to trust the information that it's receiving, and during that time frame, traffic can be blackholed. Well, if that period of time is longer than the end host's TCP timeout, then every time there's a route convergence, you kill, you end up timing out your user's TCP sessions. Is that what you're sort of driving?
Yes. At? Yes.
Wow, that's an interesting question, actually. So I don't think I've run into maybe I did run into that and I didn't know, but that's an interesting question. Because you like to imagine that, because routers are stateless, except relative to the transit traffic, that if there's a reconvergence, it shouldn't, if something happens, it should be an event that the end user doesn't particularly notice, right? Like it may seem like it stalled for a second, but then everything's normal again. What is the default TCP timeout? Isn't that like several minutes?
I'm actually just having a look at that. I just did a Google search and it's come back with saying Windows 7, the default for initial connections is 72 seconds.
Wow. So, but OSPF doesn't hold its routes down that long, right?
No. Not that long for sure. Well, if it does, you've got a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there's things like fast failover, and BFD can help with faster reconvergence, so that you don't have to worry about that. I suppose you want. I mean, there's that 50 millisecond failover goal where, if you can reconverge in 50 milliseconds, then that should not be noticeable by any application. Right. I mean, and there's a number of features that you can sort of BFD and other features you can use to sort of to get that failover time. There's actually a lot of different knobs you can use. There's incremental SPF timers. Like there's things you can do to make sure that you're only calculating SPF at a certain interval. You're sort of batching when you actually run SPF, or you only run a partial SPF calculation. You have to be careful when you're fiddling with those knobs. You want to actually use as few of those knobs as possible, because these protocols are engineered. I mean, they're designed to operate a certain way. And when you start fiddling with these sort of internal knobs, you can call these employment knobs in some situations where, you really don't want to fiddle with them, because you're actually fiddling with, the design of the protocol, right? Like John Moy went through the trouble and the effort of writing the software and designing and testing and figuring out what these values should be, and we're in there poking around their engine and, you know, trying to get it to behave in certain ways. And there could be, you know, interactions in between these knobs that have undesirable consequences.
Well, I'll tell you, that is a good place to wrap. I mean, one of the challenges with a topic like OSPF design is it is huge. It's just a massive, massive topic that is, you know, impossible to cover in one podcast, obviously. So really what we decided to do was we just ended up with some basics and a couple of common designs dealing with areas, and then got into timers a little bit. And mentioned bidirectional forwarding detection, which got a really good advertisement there. And I hope that you guys that have never heard of BFD before get a good look at it and start understanding what it does and how it could fit into your world. There's good cases there where it can make your life better. I thank Derek, and Paul for joining us. Derek's been on the show before, but I think Darren and Paul is your first time being on the podcast, and we want to do more of that sort of thing where folks come on the show that have not been on the show before. And the place to be engaged in that is the forum. There's the area on forum.packetpushers.net where we plan show outlines, and if you are interested in participating in an outline that we are proposing, please get in touch via the forum or send me or Greg an email, packetpushers@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to the show today. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter @packetpushers. Send email to packetpushers@gmail.com. You can join the Packet Pushers channel on irc.freenode.net. And of course, the forum is forum.packetpushers.net. We would appreciate it greatly if you would leave us feedback on iTunes. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.